Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the contributors to strategypage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of strategypage.com, your host. We'll be talking to Jim Dunnigan, well-known military analyst, author, and editor of strategypage.com, and Austin Bay, author, columnist, and blogger. His blog can be found at austinbay.net. Jim and Austin, welcome this morning. I thought what we could talk a little bit about is something that we talk often about on the site, which is information warfare. And there are all sorts of different aspects of information warfare, especially since we've moved into the IT electronic age. Most people probably think of information warfare as they probably have Tokyo Rose come into mind, or the Lord Haha. What was the one?
Lord Haha.
Yeah.
Germany.
But it's become a much more sophisticated enterprise in modern times, and the terrorists are actually using it quite effectively against the Western states. And I thought we could talk a little bit about that today.
Well, actually, Dan and I did a book a few years back called The Way of the Warrior, and we examined a bunch of the great, you know, generals of the past, Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, and I laid out the outline for each chapter, which basically included, as both of us understood, you know, a section on how they handled communications, not just talking to the troops, but talking to everybody they had to talk to. And one thing we discovered in examining each of those great captains was that every one of them was a great communicator. Now, this was done before there was radio or mass media in general, but what they all understood was the importance of controlling the message. Now, how you control the message has changed over literally thousands of years. In the past, Alexander the Great, for example, understood that the message to, you know, his millions of subjects was controlled by letters he sent to what we now call opinion leaders. Now, we've had opinion leaders since, well, as long as there have been humans, you know, people who are chatterboxes, people you go to find out what's the news. Now we do it, you know, via the internet, but way back when you did it over the campfire, you know, in the marketplace, wherever. Both Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, actually until in the 19th century when Napoleon discovered mass media and basically used it to control the message. The people who have used information warfare successfully have controlled the message. What we have going on today is a lot more messages, a lot more opinion leaders, but the rule remains the same. You got to get there with something that will get picked up. Now, this is where a lot of people, you know, sort of lose track. You got to understand that the news business lives off headlines. If you don't get people's attention, you don't sell newspapers that's becoming rapidly obsolete. You don't sell advertising, which is how the internet and the electronic media stay in business. You gotta basically get eyeballs. And you only get eyeballs if you're outrageous. Now, we like to make fun of the now defunct or soon to be defunct, you know, the supermarket tabloids, the World News, Daily, what have you. But those, are existing now on the internet, or on television news. If it bleeds, it leads. You got to get people's attention. And the terrorists rapidly picked up on this, realizing that even though they're committing terrible atrocities, if they can pitch themselves as the underdog and say the same lie over and over again, that's the big lie technique, which was actually ancient, but, you know, it was popularized in the 20th century by the radical socialist movements, the communists and the Nazis, that a lot of people will believe it. And so we have today in the United States a large percentage, I forget what the current percentage is, a third of the population, or some ridiculously high percentage, believes that 9/11 was staged by the CIA and the Pentagon, and that planes didn't really hit, you know, those towers. That's the big lie spread by basically people who are just out making headlines. So the terrorists, much to the frustration of us folks who study history and try and analyze things as they actually are, get more mileage out of their outrageous lies than you do with the truth.
You know, that's not exactly new, though, and it, taking advantage of headlines, sensationalist headlines. I mean, 19th century terrorists took great advantage of the fact that the telegraph links were coming in and you could spread lies like wildfire and fear.
Oh, yeah, the socialists in the 19th century and the anarchists.
I mean, sure, the anarchists were pulling that off, and that's why I said terrorists, but they were the anarchist movement, which was a terrorist...
Over a century ago.
Sure, that's... And you're looking at what they were doing, you know, propaganda by the bomb, propaganda by deed, and notice it's propaganda. Now, also propaganda...
Well, the original... The 12th century assassins. Yeah, well, the 12th century assassins did it.
Right. Sure. Well, then that was word of mouth, or by a courier, or as Jim said, you know, the campfire and letter method. I don't see modern terrorists doing too much different in terms of using information warfare, using, leveraging the desire for sensationalist headlines any more than 19th century anarchists. That's how the small but violent were able to magnify their powers, because everybody says, "Oh, they're look at how vicious they are and how brutal they are," and they of course attract the attention of the world through the information network, and it's not that their deeds weren't outrageous. I mean, they killed in the last decade of the 19th century. Right on the first couple of years of the 20th century, they killed four heads of state, as well as an Austrian empress, isn't that right? I believe they got.
Oh, I think there were 50 notable politicians and public figures they killed, even worse than Al Qaeda ever did.
Yeah, I'm just saying heads of state, and you can include William McKinley in that, you know,
right.
In his murder, as in that.
Well, even in my area here, north of me in Idaho, the governor was killed by an anarchist. Blown up.
Well, it goes on, and it's the idea is to gain political leverage by sensational crimes that receive sensational fear magnifying headlines. That's one idea. The other one is, as Jim said, to lie often. And we had an article up on Strategy Page just 3 or 4 days ago. The title of it was, I think, Mystery Dead of Gaza, or The Mystery
Dead of
Gaza. Isn't that right? I guess I could get it up online here.
The Legacy of Jenin.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the alleged Jenin massacre of 2002, which has largely been, it has been exposed as a lie.
It's become a legend.
A fabrication, sure. And yet it went on for almost 4 or 5 years about Israeli barbarity at Jenin and the Jenin massacre and the like. And as the article mentioned, it was because a number of news outlets, specifically mentioned European news outlets, said, "Oh, well, they're basically anti-Israeli to begin with, and so they'll just pump out what the claim was." When really most of the casualties at Jenin suffered by Palestinians were young men fighters who were fighting the Israelis, and a substantial number of them surrendered. I mean, there was a out and out fight going on there. The analogy there, of course, is contemporary analogy is Gaza, and the claims that several hundred, I believe off the top of my head, it was 1,300 Palestinians. Well, of course, they said the Palestinian civilians is the way that was presented, and the Israelis have, well, it's this morning online, I said, well, it's actually was 10 killed. It was a dozen, 13, and a minimal number of combat casualties. And as it turns out now, there's a reporting coming, and many of it from pro-Arab sources, that the Palestinian casualties were not 1,300, closer to somewhere.
Less than half that.
It's 600, yeah, I think that's right. Five to 600, and most of them were what we would call fighting age, combat age young men. In other words, very, very, very likely, plausibly, a rational case can be made is that they were engaging Israeli troops in combat. But the story's out there, and all the Israelis came in and just wasted parts of Gaza. And the allegation, I haven't heard it worded this way, but it'd be a similar one to Jenin, a massacre. And that doesn't stack up, but that's the way Hamas had put the story out. And certainly it's been repeated widely.
Well, what's interesting is there are actually two Palestinian information war campaigns going on. Fatah, the loser in that election that Hamas won 3 years ago, is putting out the story that Hamas were a bunch of cowards hiding behind civilians and not doing much fighting at all. And, of course, they point to the fact that only 13 Israelis were killed and only, you know, I think 9 of them were military and 3 and 4 were from friendly fires. So the Hamas only killed 5 Israeli soldiers, 5 or 6. And the stories are coming out from Palestinians, very brave Palestinians. There was one in the Middle Eastern, well, in the Israeli media today, or the Middle Eastern and West Bank, the pro Fatah media, about a farmer who lived on a plot of land on the high ground, such as it is in Gaza, overlooking Sderot, you know, the closest Israeli town to the Gaza, which has been hammered by thousands of these rockets over the last 8 years. And he said, very bravely, I hope he's getting out of Gaza real quick, he said that the Hamas came in and forced his family to stay in the house, and they fired rockets, and apparently the fact that the farmhouse was occupied, you know, it prevented it from getting a smart bomb on it. Whatever. You know, again, this is Fatah playing its information war game, trying to make Hamas look like a bunch of wussies, you know, hiding behind, you know, women's skirts. The advantage Fatah has is that most of the Arab world sees the information war being fought by Hamas as a pro-Iranian information war. So it's a very confused situation because no Arab wants to be thought of as an ally of Israel. But if you go up against Hamas in the recent war, you know, in information war, you're basically an ally of Israel. But they basically fear Iran more than they fear Israel. So the information war is becoming confused because of these rather tricky Middle Eastern, you know, antagonisms.
Now
I just pulled up the mystery dead of Gaza article, and we've got 500 dead in there in the report, which is right in line with what. My memory, what Jim said. You know, the point on this is that the first claims of total lost appear to be inflated. We'll know more over time. We'll get a better grip on it as the Israelis, as well as Fatah, gets checks, as it points out in the article, with medical personnel who actually dealt with the dead and wounded, but the facts coming out, the information coming out now, which strikes me as much more substantiated than the initial claims are, is that a majority of the dead were Hamas fighters, and that is not, of course, the story that was put out. It was the story that Hamas put out, and this is the information warfare component. It's right in line with Hezbollah, which is that they were using, you know, human shields. They don't like the term human shields. What Jim described as the farmer, he was actually being used as a human shield. But the thing is that we're nested within our own civilian population, and when the Israelis kill the civilian population, we accuse them of being war criminals and mass murderers. And that's the way that the Hamas information warfare line, that particular information warfare line of operation proceeded throughout the battles from December through middle of January.
Now, in the U.S., we have a group of people that aren't terrorists but are terrorist supporters that have started using our newspapers and our politically correct ideas to make the terrorists look better. For instance, I know one of the things that's been done here in the United States is if the newspapers mention somebody as a Muslim, that they jump on the newspapers and get them to just report it as a terrorist, not as, you know, coming having a certain religious background.
That's, again, part of a well-crafted information war campaign where you try and make your side seem to be the good guys. And by taking religion out of it, you make the terrorists more anonymous. When, you know, anybody who knows anything about terrorism knows that most of it is based upon, you know, Islam. You know, I mean, it's religious-based terrorism. So obviously, if you're an Islamic terrorist, you want to play that down. You know, Islam is a religion of peace, which, of course, it has never been, but that's another story, which nobody wants to run with.
Yeah, nobody wants to read the history again, right, Jim?
Well, if it's inconvenient, you don't want to read it. But no, you're right. In general, people don't want to bother with history because history hasn't got a lot of profitable headlines in it. History
now, what
can be boring. That's why they don't study it in school anymore.
Now, one of the interesting things with this last go-around with Gaza was, and we posted a lot of these videos up on our site, was what the IDF was doing. That they had decided, hey, YouTube's a way to get information out there. And so they were releasing a lot of their video from their UAVs, from their fighters and like that onto the internet to show people what was happening.
Yes, this time around, the Israelis, they finally caught on that they were being snookered. They tried to fight fire with fire. They were pretty successful. Just by putting that stuff out there, especially the video, they were simply following up on the fact that without trying in the past, a lot of this video, some of the requests, we have them on strategy page, a lot of them. One of the classics, this was about the time of Jenin, after Jenin, I believe, but the Fatah, all the Palestinian groups, they had a standard operating procedure. Whenever there was an Israeli attack, like a bombing, a missile, to take out a terrorist leader, they would immediately announce that there were only civilian casualties. This is called because, you know, there is a press in the Palestinian areas. And the word would get out that, you know, some big terrorist muckamucka or some big guy who was known to be a terrorist was suddenly dead. There would be a funeral because in Islamic practice, you bury the guy right away within 24 hours. Well, what the Palestinians would always do was claim that civilians were killed and immediately hold funerals. Now, what these, a lot of these funerals were setups. There was no dead body. And what this caught, it was obviously an Israeli, you know, UAV, was they were carrying a body and one of the pallbearers stumbled and the body fell off and then the body gets up and climbs back up on the bier, the stretcher, and they continue carrying him.
Right.
It turns out that if you have enough UAVs up there and enough of this video, you will witness a lot of these things being set up before they go off for their photo opportunity. This is what Israel is trying to jump on. They're always going to play catch-up because the actual setup, if well done, and these Palestinians are good at it, is always more of an attractive headline than the exposé. But at least they're fighting back.
Right.
There is an audience that they will get that you get out of running UAV video, and that is a tech crowd that is. There's a huge tech crowd on the internet, Dan. We
right.
know that, and they're fascinated by when the Israelis can put that's got kind of video from UAVs and showing gadgets, showing engagements. So there's an audience for it. Now, whether it is the audience that, as Jim says, are opinion leaders or the sensationalists, that's up for grabs. But there are a substantial number of people that will appeal to them. And the Israelis are aware of it. They're not the only ones aware of it. The U.S. Air Force has mined that for years. They certainly learned it in 1991 in Desert Storm with their greatest hits release, which that wasn't the official name of it, but it was a video of smart bomb strikes in Kuwait and Iraq. And some of that still shows up on cable television from those that particular video the Air Force did. That was a Air Force, in a more narrowly defined sense, information campaign. It was we're going to show you what our weapons can do, and way back there was a psychological aim of saying, hey, bad guys like North Korea, like at that time still Libya, like Saddam still, take a look at what we can do technologically.
Right.
Don't confuse yourselves. So that's another aspect of that. That was a demonstration of that Air Force video. Was a demonstration of power, and it had the technical historical component, but it also had a psychological message to it, which is the intent of information warfare.
Right. So let's jump up one level then and talk a little bit about organized nation states and their information warfare efforts.
Jim, may I start with that one?
Well, they're usually non-existent. Let me finish. The countries with a free press tend not to have one because the free press will jump all over you if you try and control the press. That's the whole point of a free press, is you don't manipulate. The countries without a free press do control the message and have for a long time. You know, the radical socialist movement of the 20th century, you know, the Nazis and the communists, that's how they maintain their power, by controlling the media. Napoleon was actually the first to do this, with a mass media, and in the 19th century, he doesn't get much credit for that. I don't know if that's because of his advocates, covering up his tracks or what, but, it's on the public record, so to speak, how he controlled the mass media. And in the 20th century, and into the 21st century, this has become a cornerstone of state control, and it's now being attacked by the Internet. Which is anarchy as far as, a police state is concerned. And this is presenting opportunities which the free countries, as it were, are not really taking enough advantage of. And that's a big issue in the Department of Defense, where it's believed that, we could do more with this. Actually, we probably are doing more with it, but we're not talking about it. I know I lectured down at the Central Intelligence Agency a few years ago, and I brought it up, and there were some interesting looks in the audience because it was an unclassified, lecture. And so from what I gather, there is something being done, but obviously you don't talk about it, otherwise it's not going to work as well.
Well, I know one of the things that the military got whacked for, and it wasn't them that I think was responsible for it, was the stories that came out about Jessica Lynch right at the beginning, and how that was the free press felt like they were trying to be manipulated by the military with that.
Well, that was basically a foul ball by the media, because any time the military is called upon to make a statement, if there's anything the media can find out about it that was incorrect, or that smells of a pitch, a spin and what have you, they're going to jump all over you. So you can't win it. That's why the military likes to say nothing, because they know if they say anything, it's going to be spun right back at them, simply because that's a cheap headline on a slow news day. And I've seen that. I've been doing I did the pundit bit for about 3 decades, and my God, I can't count how many times I saw that, where a news director would say, well, how can we spin this right back at them?
Right. Austin, you wanted to talk about China?
No, I was.
They're not really trying to spin you, sir. You asked for a statement. They gave you a statement. And this guy feels that's just an opportunity. That's not a statement.
All right.
You were saying taking it up a level, I was wondering if we're going to point out we've got a recent article up there. Jim, I think you wrote it. It's the January 27th piece, A Billion Victims Rising.
Yes, that's mine. Yeah.
You wrote that one. Yeah, but the interesting point in this is the discussion of China spending $7.5 billion to upgrade CCTV, Xinhua, and People's Daily into major international outlets, and what China's doing. This is an extremely sophisticated information operation. Is it information warfare? Well,
yes, because they're positioning their national news outlet, their state-controlled news outlets, as world-class up there with CNN and BBC, and then, of course, they can spin it as needed. You can't spin it too outrageously, but as you're right. They do it subtly enough. You reap great dividends.
It is information warfare, because what they're doing on the outside, as the article points out, is that this English language and print and broadcast news services are largely, increasingly uncensored. Heavens, there's good material Xinhua puts out on covering a number of areas in Africa. When I say good, factually based, and they're reporting, they'll have a reporter out there who takes a government statement and local and an opposition statement and the like. Okay, that's what they're doing on the outside. That said, they censor what goes on in domestic content. Let's try to give the impression the overseas broadcasts are not censored. Interior is censored.
Well, actually, wait a minute. They are censored to a point. You're right. The individual, we both use them, you know, and the thing with using material coming from countries like Russia and China is that if it takes years, they should teach this at universities, but that's another story. You got to know what to look for. You know, it's like looking at people's faces, reading people's faces and things like that. They, for example, in China, you'll notice that out of the Chinese English language, you know, international reporting, you'll never find any discussion about what China is doing there, except, you know, a puff thing.
But you have
to go to AFP, you know, the Agence France-Presse or the BBC or Reuters or something like that. And there, it's amazing. And, of course, what's interesting is, if you're searching for news on the Internet, you use an RSS feed or something like this, it's right there on the screen. You know, it's so obvious. You know, you line up, you sort, you know, the Chinese sources, and then you sort the Western sources. Hey, you know, these people are living in a different Africa. Certain things for the Chinese don't exist in Africa.
There is a lineup, though, Jim. Just as I was, when I was a moment ago starting to describe, they'll have the African government statement, African opposition statements, and following certain kinds of things that you'd report in
if it doesn't involve China, it's great reporting. They are putting people on the ground, you know, to their credit, in places where there are very few Western reporters, usually because it's too goddamn dangerous. But a Chinese reporter, if he or she, I've seen female, you know, bylines, if you want to make your bones, you basically, you know, go to Africa. And go to dangerous places, and if you survive, you know, a few years in those places reporting, you know, good things will come to you, but you're betting your life.
Well, the thing is, my point is that material that I'm, the examples I'm giving, it's accurate. But what Jim is saying, there's part of the story missing.
Yeah, certain things you just don't even send back to the head office because they'll just cut it.
Well, and what Jim just described is, it's pretty, you know, in your face when you compare the other reporting and you see, yeah, there are all these parts, 60% of it lines up, and then what's missing is what Chinese diplomats have to say, other than, you know, their kind of boilerplate kind of stuff.
Well, or the fact that Chinese merchants are very active in dealing with the blood products, not just diamonds, but, you know, raw materials, things that are basically being taken out illegally, you know, in Africa, coal tar and what have you. There's a lot of Chinese involved in that business. Now, Reuters, you know, might have a guy reporting on that, but a Chinese reporter won't touch it for obvious reasons.
Well, and this is an example. I would say that this is, if we're discussing information warfare, this is an information operation. It's a very large-scale one. It's being run by a very curious kind of dictatorship that still has the kind, the ability to censor and control its news media to present an impression. And look, part of what they're up to, and they expand this, and this is pointed out in that article Jim wrote, it's the Chinese want to stop or counter negative stories about China, especially, what's the subject? Human rights. The other one is discontent. I said human rights, and this kind of feeds into it. Discontent in the Chinese population as the recession sets in.
Well, actually, you know, another thing we shouldn't forget is the billions of dollars the Arab Gulf states have spent on basically creating a more pro-Arab atmosphere in the media. Now, they started doing this through academia. How many chairs have they endowed? You know, to study, study the Arab world, study Islam and what have you. Now, what does this get you? It gets you people writing papers, writing freelancing stringers for mass media, becoming pundits, experts you call on, who all give a kinder and gentler view of the Arab world. And covers up things that, the Arabs would rather not have you talk about. For example, now I hear this from guys, expatriates, and some Arabs, Saudi citizens, have told me, says, you wouldn't believe the kind of crap that gets out on Saudi TV and especially in some of the mosques. You want to hear fire and brimstone against Jews and non-Muslims in general, not just the Jews. We're all going to hell if we're not Muslims, according to these guys. And the government just lets this stuff go on. They consider it a safety valve. But this is something they'd rather not get reported in the West because it doesn't reflect on that.
Let's give them their claim is, take a look at the power of the so-called Israeli lobby in the United States in academic and in influencing media as well. It's an analog to special interest complaint here in the United States, alleging that another special interest has more media influence than.
Every ethnic group in this country, with the possible exception of the Germans, has an ethnic lobby. And I say the exception of the Germans because they were involved in two world wars against us. And before World War I, there was a very strong German, ethnic lobby, the German lobby, because they are the largest single ethnic group in the United States. And because of the two world wars, that disappeared.
Yeah, there were German newspapers in the New
exactly in
San
Texas.
Antonio. I mean, sure.
English, German language. But in the United States, that's basically custom. And what basically annoys the Arabs is the Israelis are so successful at it. But then the Israelis don't have much choice. There wasn't much of a Jewish lobby before World War II. But after World War II, the whole Holocaust thing, and that only slowly gathered speed after World War II. And it wasn't until the 60s that the Israeli lobby became, really powerful. And again, that was, a combination of necessity and capability. And the Arabs are just jealous. But they've been playing catch-up the last 30 years.
Israel didn't come into existence until after World War II. I mean, you can't have an Israel.
Well, exactly. There was a sense of Jewish, Jewish unity. There are Jewish issues. And they did come up before World War II. They tried, for example, when the Nazis came out, that's when it really started coming together. It's, my God, these people are persecuting. Well, actually, it was even in the 19th century, the pogroms against the Jews in Russia. They call it pogroms. They're basically massacring and raping and what have you, ethnic cleansing, as it were, without moving the people around that much. And the Jewish media, in the ethnic media in the United States, they basically went to the mass media and said, hey, and there were stories, and it did percolate all the way up to the government, and there were diplomatic inquiries made. Well, why are you killing all these people? And the Russians would come back with usually, the Jewish conspiracy, protocols of the elders of Zion. It did become an issue, but it didn't become a huge issue. And so, yes, as you say, Israel was created, and suddenly you had, all these Arabs wanting to wipe out Jews again. And I don't think that was a hard sell in the United States, you know, protecting Israel. It's a difficult sell protecting Islamic terrorists.
It wasn't in the, a hard sell at all. In fact, it was overdue. Given the Holocaust and the Nazi-led genocide. My point on that, though, when you were pointing out what this burgeoning, it's growing. This Arab lobby is that it follows a pattern that you've seen with other, as you mentioned, ethnic lobbies, ethnic groups. In the United States, and I would even say special interest lobbies, and you're moving, therefore, though, out of information warfare into information political influence in a democratic polity, which is it goes on, but that's part and parcel of what you do in a structured society where the rule of law is in force. The point I would make out of this is that there are folks that say, well, it's all information warfare, and what the Democratic Party's up to and the Republican Party to is information warfare. Well, no, it's influence, because they're in a legal structure. Warfare, we can talk about this, but it's dealing outside the bounds of a nation state with the rule of law. It's out there in the anarchy and havoc of the international sphere. So
right.
Thought about the way to shape at least one way to shape and consider information warfare.
Right. Now, one of the things we're out of time today, but something that we're going to have to pick up on another day is that cyber warfare now gets linked in with information warfare, and that's something that we'll need to save for another day, though.
Well, it's a medium, and it is a medium for carrying information, and it's certainly the next right there. All right, guys, next week then.
Yep, next time.
Take care.
Bye.